Now it's time for a morning show history lesson with a difference. How much do you think you know about ancient Egypt? My Egyptian knowledge is somewhat limited, I'm embarrassed to say, but I think I know the basics. Tombs, temples, pyramids, and that song by the Bangles. My next guest book, though, aims to expose what he calls the real truth behind ancient Egypt. He's the author of a number of provocative books, a former science writer for the Sunday Times, and a documentary maker. He lives just outside of, as I referred to earlier, the centre of the universe, Bridgewater. Professor Robert Temple joins us on the morning show. Good morning, Robert.
Morning, Emma. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you here. You've lived in Somerset for over 30 years, but tell us where you were born.
Well, I come from Kentucky, which is very like Somerset, and I've spent most of my life in England, and when I had the chance to get out of London and go native, I chose to come to a place that was very similar to Kentucky, and here I am in Somerset, where my favorite cheese is cheddar, and I'm not averse to cider.
I'm sure you're not. It's always difficult to know where to start with somebody like yourself who's done so much already in their life. When you left education, what path did you take? How does one go about becoming a professor and specialising in certain things? Because you seem to have done an awful lot so far in your career.
Well, I've written many books, 15, 16, whatever it is, and mostly on different subjects because I jump around a bit. I'm easily bored, you see. And also I'm always poking my nose in other people's business. And that's partly because I'm a historian of science, and that means you leap from country to country and era to era, and you do ruffle a lot of academic feathers that way, because you suddenly turn up, somebody spent their life doing whatever it is, and then suddenly in comes this historian of science who says, I'm interested in the gadgets that were being used by your people that you spent your life studying. And then they get a bit annoyed by that, because then you're gone again and you're off to the next country in the next era.
So before we talk about ancient Egypt, what kind of eras and countries have you stirred up previously?
Well, I did a book on the history of Chinese science. And so my second professorial appointment was as professor of the history and philosophy of science at China's leading technical university in Beijing. It's called Tsinghua. And I've had a great deal of connection with China. I've spent a very great deal of time there. And that's one area. I've done things to do with ancient Greece a great deal. In fact, I've worked in archaeology in the field in Greece, Italy, and Egypt.
And has it always been your mission to dispel what are long-held notions and beliefs, or are you just about finding the truth?
Well, I think I'm a mischievous character, and I never believe what anybody tells me, because I think everybody's wrong, including myself, and so I'm always interested to find out why they're wrong, and so I am mischievous, there's no doubt about it, but I'm also primarily interested in getting at the truth, and the truth is always different than what everybody thinks it is. That's what I've discovered in my lifetime.
And that must upset a few people along the way.
Well, I think it's nice when people get upset, because that's the way to grow, isn't it, when you're challenged.
Some people, like you said, they have spent their life dedicated to a particular era in time or a particular period in history, and believe they know it all and think it all, and you come in and say, oh no, actually, well, let's question how that was actually done.
Well, everybody has a tendency to go rigid, you know, they do what they do, and don't bother me, I'm doing what I'm doing. And I think it's a good thing to shake everybody up. I think everybody should be shaken up all the time in their daily lives as well as in their careers, because it keeps you thinking. You don't want to just become a sleepwalker.
One of the quotes that have been put out with your most recent book, which made me smile, it was a quote from The Guardian. It says, before you turn off, Robert Temple is not the smooth hustler often associated with such theories. His work is of a respectable scholarship. So often you'll have people who, you know, trying to dispel a theory or a myth, who are a little bit, you know, a bit canny, a little bit doing it for their own reasons. But you're doing it because of your true interest in these subjects.
Oh, yeah. So what they mean about smooth hustlers is the various people, some of whom I know, who write books either for egotistical purposes or to make a quick buck, as they say in America. In fact, we can still say a quick pound, although I expect the euro is looming.
Okay, ancient Egypt then. When did you decide to get your teeth into this area?
Well, I became interested in Egypt as a small child, as I think many people have done, without knowing anything about it. When you're browsing around through encyclopedias and things, I don't know if anybody still does that, but when I was a child, we still had pieces of paper in front of us instead of screens, because there were no computers, of course. And I used to see these pictures of Egyptians, and I thought, they're funny-looking people. What's that all about? And then you'd see the odd picture of a pyramid and say, why would anybody want to build that? And that's a good question. Why would anybody want to build?
And how?
Yes. You know, we take these things for granted because they're sitting there in Egypt, but what are they for, and how did they get there?
So let's start with what we think we know then. So everybody thinks, what does everybody think they know about Egypt? I mentioned it there in my introduction. Tombs, you know, people buried in tombs, in very ornate, you know, caskets. Temples, pyramids, the way the pyramids were built. They dragged all that stone up there by hand, and it took them years and years to build it. And the writings on the wall, the carvings, all those kinds of things. What we think we know. What was it that you have found out not to be true?
Well, I have a colleague in Greece who used to be a nuclear physicist, and he's now a professor of archaeometry at a Greek university, and he has developed a new dating technique which can date stone buildings directly for the first time. It's quite different from carbon dating, which dates organic remains. Mm. And so we have redated the pyramids at Giza in Egypt, and that's quite a challenging thing because we got the wrong result. We found that they're too old, but they're not as old as a lot of people would like them to be, but they're certainly not the date that they're supposed to be. This brings to mind the problem of, well, if they're too old, who was around at that time who could have built them? Because they clearly weren't built by the people we think they were built by. Mm. So who did it? And what's going on? This is the fundamental start to the book, that the pyramids are too old. And as they're so gigantic, because the Great Pyramid covers an area of 13.5 acres at its base, I mean, these are immense structures. For those who haven't actually been there and seen them with their own eyes, the photographs can't even begin to give you an idea of how unbelievably gigantic these things are. And how difficult they must have been to construct. Mm. So we always thought that, and the conventional knowledge has it, that the pyramids were built by some pharaohs called Cheops, Khafre, and Mykerinus, who all lived in what's called the Fourth Dynasty of Egypt, in the period which is known as the Old Kingdom, which was followed by a Middle Kingdom and a New Kingdom. And so my study of Egypt has been about what was going on in the Old Kingdom and earlier. I haven't concerned myself with anything more recent than 2000 BC. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the really early stuff. And we've now got a mean date for the pyramids of 3090 BC, plus or minus 500 years, because you get a big spread of date with this new technique. But what that means is that they were built before these pharaohs were born. Yeah. Therefore, those pharaohs didn't build them.
So who did?
Well, this is the problem.
And how do you go about finding out?
Well, I rootle around in all the books. I have a huge Egyptological library, probably one of the largest private ones in the world by now. And I discovered that in 1938, Walter Emery, the very distinguished British Egyptologist, who was a fine fellow, discovered a pyramid of what's known as the First Dynasty at Saqqara, which was 43 feet high and 75 feet long, which never gets discussed. And it probably doesn't get discussed because it's a bit awkward and makes people nervous, because it doesn't fit the theories of what they call pyramid evolutionary design, which is a theory that has to be thrown out now. Anyway, and so I discussed that, and I discovered some very weird things about that structure. And another one, it's a Saqqara known as the Step Pyramid, and the connection between the two. So everything's basically up in the air about pyramids, because the big ones now seem to have come first, and the smaller ones later. And that sort of throws the theory out.
When you are putting together stuff like this, do you get terribly excited because you think this is going to stir a few people up? Or do you think, where do you get your thrills from? That's what I'm trying to establish, because this is big stuff. This is stuff that will, you know, upset a lot of people or just generally shift everything. I'm thinking about all the educational books about Egypt and the tourism industry around Egypt and that kind of thing. Does it excite you?
Well, I like the process of research, and I'm a kind of detective of the ancient world. I like looking for the missing bodies, and they're not always in the tombs. And I consider myself a kind of detective, because I enjoy looking for the answers to riddles and mysteries, and I never give up. You know, I sometimes, I'm still investigating things that I started investigating 40 years ago, and I never stop. You can't, there's no off switch. So I just want to find the answers to all the riddles.
You're living here in Somerset. Are there any Somerset sort of established, recognized historical facts that you would like to maybe rootle around in?
Well, at the end of this book, Egyptian Dawn, the final chapter is about the megalithic societies which created Stonehenge and Avebury in Britain and Stanton Drew, which is in Somerset, which is our own megalithic ring, which is made of granite. And unfortunately, not a great many of those stones remain because they were all carried away by those overzealous Somerset farmers. And we know what they're like, don't we, because they're our neighbours.
Many of them will be listening this morning.
And they've probably got them all out in the shed somewhere, because they might come in handy.
Robert's coming to rootle around in your sheds, beware.
Yes, watch out.
Yep, so what are you going to do with this?
Well, when I realised that the pyramids were too old, I started looking around for who could have built the damn things. And I realised there was something wrong with the area of Egypt known as the Delta, which is in the north. And that there were people living there who are called loosely the Libyans, but nobody knows who the Libyans really were. So I started studying the North African coastline. And many years ago, my wife Olivia and I went to see the world's largest megalithic ring, which is bigger than Stanton Drew, Stonehenge, or Avebury, which is in Morocco. It's called Mazoura. And I photographed it, and that's all in the book. And also there's a website that goes with the book, which is free. That's www.egyptiandawn.info. And you get a lot more stuff there about this huge Moroccan megalithic ring, which is built by the same culture that built Karnak in Brittany and the megalithic rings in Britain and the monuments in Ireland. This was a coastal Atlantic civilization. And I then discovered more recently that the whole of the North African coast is full of megalithic rings and also a lot of hundreds of trilithons, which are the later phase of Stonehenge, which are all over Libya and Algeria. And of course, there's this huge place in Morocco. And there was this vast ancient megalithic civilization that came right to the borders of Egypt. And I believe these people were related to the inhabitants of the Western Egyptian Delta. And I think that these people, who had stone technology, and we know from Antiquera in Spain, for instance, one of their great monuments, that they were able to lift 200-ton stones. They had the stone technology, the geometry, the astronomy, and the mathematics to be capable of building the Great Pyramid. And I believe they at least contributed to that in concert with the locals if they didn't just do it themselves. And then by the time those pharaohs who are in the history books came along, they did what's called usurping a monument. They took them over and surrounded them with tombs of all their family and everything and said, "This is mine."
Claimed it as their own.
Yes.
It's fascinating stuff. Honestly, it's absolutely... I didn't know much about this before this morning, and I've learnt so much already. Watch This Space, I think, should be your new middle name. Professor Robert Watch This Space Temple, because this is a man on a mission. The book's called Egyptian Dawn. It's published by Century. It's out now. And as Robert said as well, you can also visit the website egyptiandawn.info to find out more. Will you keep us up to date with what you're up to, Robert?
I will, Emma. And if I were to come back, I could tell you about the unopened tombs which I've found at Giza, 7 of them.
Oh, I'm going to get Robert back very soon. Hope you enjoyed that. I did.